हरि भूर्भुवस्व तत्सवितुर्वरेण्यं भर्गो देवस्य धीमहि धियो यो न प्रचोदयात्। ॐ मे वी मेडिटेट on that Supreme Being who dwells in the hearts of all. He is the source and sustenance of this universe. In Him we live, move and have our being. May He illumine our hearts and may He guide us in every way. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. We have been studying the Viveka Chudamuni, or crest jewel of discrimination, by the great seer philosopher Shankara. The fundamental truth, or the supreme truth, that has been taught, not only in Vedanta, but in every religion of the world, is that there is one existence, one reality. Call that God or Brahman or Christ or Buddha, does not matter. But there is one reality, and by reality what is meant? That which is and which is never not. In other words, the abiding, the eternal, the unchangeable existence. And there is that reality, the universe that we see, the appearance, is superimposed upon that reality. What we see with our senses, with our mind, with all our experiences of the senses, what we sense and perceive, is Brahman, is God. Misread. We see the appearance. And this appearance is a shadow. It is changing all the time, shifting all the time. If you consider the nature of this appearance, you will realize that today it is, next moment it is not. All the time in a flux. This body that we consider as so real, so tangible, has no reality. As one great saint said, it will end in just a handful of ashes. There is nothing pessimistic about it. Anything that you sense or perceive in the universe is only an appearance. And that appearance is vanishing all the time. The substance is what we see as substance, as reality, now, is changing all the time. It's becoming unreal every moment. And yet we are holding fast to that as something real. Now again, that God or Brahman or whatever name you may give, it is that which is infinite being, infinite wisdom and infinite love, or absolute existence, absolute knowledge and absolute bliss. That is the reality. And that reality, again, is not anywhere you don't have to find anywhere else. Here within yourself. What you call your Atman, the Self, I, that is that reality. You see, here is something in the Vedantic ideal. Generally, one may say, a spark of that is in me. A spark of that is in being. But no. Completely, infinitely, in its total reality, is dwelling in every heart, everywhere. And when this truth is taught, tattam asi, that thou art, or I and my Father are one, it is the one reality. But we are caught, as it were. Now, who is caught in this ignorance? Who is caught in this bondage? Generally, you know, nobody, very few realize that he is in bondage. Very few has the understanding that the reality within him is Brahman or God. Generally, when they try to find religion or pray to God way above somewhere, or they think if they go to a church or a temple or the Bible or the Gita or the Vedas or the scriptures, they'll find religion. Yeah. They can tell you about how to find and where to find, and ultimately you will realize that you have to find him within yourself. And he dwells in his total reality, in his infinite, in his infinitude, in every one of us. But that is to be experienced. You see, if you simply say, I am Brahman, no, that will not help you. But experience means, just as I am experiencing this body as something, I see something before me, I see you all, is no imagination, no guesswork. And that reality, that experience is more than this experience. It is being. And the process, there is the bondage, ignorance. And whose ignorance is this? Atman has no ignorance. Brahman, God, has no ignorance. But there has arisen through some ignorance which is inexplicable. There has come this sense, I am. A sense of ego. And this ego, philosophically or psychologically, it's the Atman identifying with the body, mind, senses, etc. And somehow this ignorance has happened. How, we do not know. It's a matter of fact. And this ignorance has to be removed. And through this ignorance there is this bondage. Bondage means what again? Ignorance and bondage is the same. It means we have forgotten. And this ego has arisen, sense of ego, self-consciousness. You see, in the lower animals it is not evolved. But this has to evolve in order that we can transcend this. And as Ramakrishna used to say, when this ego dies, all troubles cease. You realize that Atman, Satchidananda. Now, of course, we have to go step by step. And so, first thing is discrimination. This discrimination has to arise before you seek for spiritual life, because discrimination means you have to discriminate and find out what exactly is the reality. See? You'll find many people, most people, majority of people, consider, for instance, this body, this surface life as something real, sense pleasures something real, and something tangible, something real. And as long as they consider all this as something real, the discrimination has not come. And when one begins to discriminate, one realizes, yes, I sense and perceive this is so tangible, but it doesn't last. But again, there are people who consider, well, what matters? As long as I am living, let me enjoy life. And when I am dead, I am dead. But I wish they could enjoy life. And of course, as long as one is quite satisfied with the senses, one does not need any God, any religion. But when you realize that this is all just vanity, 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 nothing else. This is not Vedanta only. Please understand that. But I am giving you the essence of all religions. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity except to love God. That's what the Bible also says. All is vanity. And this discrimination has to arise. And then we have to hear about this truth, reason upon this truth, meditate upon this truth, and then this ignorance has to vanish, disappear. And that is what this great teacher is teaching us. So he points out, this bondage cannot be broken by weapons or by wind or by fire or by millions of acts. Nothing but the sharp sword of knowledge can cut through this bondage. But this knowledge that he speaks of is not something intellectual. That you may say, oh yes, I understand. That doesn't help. It is something that is transcending these senses, transcending these three states of consciousness, waking, dreaming and dreamless sleep, is another consciousness, pure consciousness. And you can rise that because you have that power, you have that capacity. That is the very essence of your being. You know, you, I, and every being always in reality remain one with Brahman. That's our true being, true nature. Now all this ignorance that has come to us, or we do wrong deeds or good deeds, or we are thinking ignorantly, all these ignorance is temporary. Ignorance is not permanent. You see, it is, what illustration can I give you? Take for instance a diamond covered with dirt. But the luster of the diamond is there, and this dirt that has accrued, that has gathered upon this diamond, that's not real. That's not the nature of the diamond. There's something temporarily covering it. And the same with every one of us. It's a temporary covering of ignorance. And they have no reality. Wickedness, sin, what you may call, that's nothing. That's just temporary. They will all vanish. They'll all disappear. And the luminosity of the Atman will break through in every one of us. But there arises that discrimination. You have to go through a process of purification, as it were. So nothing but the sharp sword of knowledge can cut through this bondage. It is forged by discrimination and made keen by purity of heart through divine grace. Now that divine grace again is there. Not from outside it comes. In other words, there is that luster of God, the grace of God shining all the time. You have to try to remove that dirt and dust that has accumulated. So, purity of discrimination and purity of heart. A man must faithfully and devotedly fulfill the duties of life as the scriptures prescribe. This purifies the heart. You see, we are all born under certain conditions and circumstances of life. And we have certain duties to perform. And we must perform our duties. Again, it is taught, we must perform actions and duties as worship. You see, without work, without action, without performing our duties, we cannot achieve purity of heart. And there are duties, stations of life. For instance, a man is a student, householder, retired, monk. Each has a duty according to the station of his life. And such duties have to be performed. Then it is that the heart becomes purified. Now again, such duties have to be performed without seeking for the results of the action. You have a duty to your husband. You have a duty to your wife. You have a duty to your children. Everybody does those duties, but that does not purify the heart. But if you do perform those duties in the right attitude, in the right spirit, In this sense, for instance, first thing, you do your duty to your husband, and then you demand the from the husband. No. Selflessly. You do your duties by your children. Do not expect anything. Give your love. Not expect anything. And how can it be done? Only when you learn to see that God is present everywhere. He is the reality, He is the substance. And that consciousness has to come. Then, with that consciousness, if you act, then that purifies the heart. A man whose heart is pure realizes the Supreme Atman. Thereby, he destroys his bondage to worldliness, root and all. Wrapped in its five coverings, beginning with the physical, which are the products of its own maya, the Atman remains hidden as the water of a pond is hidden by a veil of scum. You see what a beautiful illustration is given. You see water. There is pure water, covered by a veil of scum. You don't see the water. Similarly, there is this Atman, a God dwelling within each one of us. Blissful, pure consciousness, full of wisdom, eternal, immortal life that does not die, does not change, always blissful, is there. And this scum covering it, that scum is not real. That scum is removable. It's a dirt accumulated. And what are those wrapped in its five coverings? It's beginning with the physical. Body is a covering. And it has become a covering, and then the identification is there with the body. But it is just a scum or sheath covering, not the reality. And so you will find explained bodily covering, physical, then that is annamaya, and then pranamaya, life breath, what you see, that's a covering. Then manas or mind is a covering. Then vijnana or intellect is a covering, and then ego is a covering. These five sheaths of ignorance covering the Atman. And we have to free ourselves from these coverings, from these sheaths. How? We have to realize, we have to experience, I am not the body. I am not the mind, I am not the intellect, not the senses. I am that Atman, I am God, I am Brahman. You see, it's a matter of experience. But these are the coverings we should know. And we must not misunderstand. You see, when it is taught, I and my father are one, or that thou art, or I am Brahman, see, it doesn't mean that this sense of ego, which is connected with the body, identified with the body, mind and senses, which is subject to pleasure and pain, which is subject to birth and death. You see, all these are subjects to birth and death. All these are subjects to change all the time. And so when from our consciousness we can free ourselves from all these coverings, then the Atman shines, reveals itself. When the scum is removed, the pure water is clearly seen. It takes away a man's thirst, cools him immediately, and makes him happy. When all the five coverings are removed from our consciousness, that identification, the pure Atman is revealed. It is revealed as God dwelling within, as unending, unalloyed bliss, as the supreme and self-luminous being. The wise man who seeks liberation from bondage must discriminate between Atman and non-Atman. You see, this is the discrimination. I am not the body. This is non-Atman. I am not the mind. Even you have to detach yourself from your mind. You see, there's a mood, for instance, depression comes in the mind. Detach yourself. Or an elation comes in the mind. Try to detach yourself. You are that unchangeable, blissful consciousness. But of course, it is not so easy to do that. But even at least for a second, if you try, you are achieving something, I say. If for a moment you think yourself to be Atman, or if for a moment you think of God dwelling within, you have grown. You see, oftentimes it happens. The water scum, you remove it, you see the water, again the scum covers it. So, when the scums are completely removed, then you have the pure water all the time. And that's what we have to do. But every moment you are trying to remove the scum, you are progressing. You know, my master used to say, if you move one step towards God, He comes down 100 steps towards you. The wise man who seeks liberation from bondage must discriminate between Atman and non-Atman. In this way he can realize the Atman, which is infinite being, infinite wisdom, and infinite love. Thus he finds happiness. The Atman dwells within, free from attachment and beyond all action. You see, always, Atman has not been contaminated by any action or by any thought of the individual. But of course the individual, as long as he thinks he is the doer, he is the thinker, he has to take the consequences. And that's what is known as the law of karma. But this law of karma does not attach itself to the Atman. The moment you realize Atman, the moment you realize God, you are free from karmas, free from all bondages. And Sri Ramakrishna used to emphasize this one truth, that it is possible for every human being to realize the Self, to realize God, because that God is dwelling within everyone. And as we read in the Gita, Sri Krishna, another great divine incarnation, says, even if the vilest of the vile worships me with whole soul devotion, soon does he become a saint. That whole soul devotion. A man must separate this Atman from every object of experience as a stalk of grass is separated from its enveloping sheath. Then he must dissolve into the Atman all those appearances which make up the world of name and form. He is indeed a free soul who can remain thus absorbed in the Atman alone. I see some questions perhaps here waiting. In our scripture it is mentioned, Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually. Have we in the Hindu scriptures a priest like that? What is his name? I don't know of any such priest. Do we have to have any such priest? Is there a parallel in Vedanta to the Christian's mortification? Well, yes, not in Vedanta, but there are Hindus who mortify their bodies and flesh just like the Christians. You know, one time a good friend of mine gave me a book, The Life of a Great Christian Mystic, to read. He thought that that's a wonderful saint. And as I read a few pages, it says how he used to, what do you call, flog himself every night until the blood would come out, and then he would go to bed so that no lust would come to him. But could he think of God then? Could he devote himself to God? So what good is that? I have seen in India a man holding his hand like that and this way for 12 years. When I saw him, he had already gone 12 years holding his hand like that. It's a real mortification. And then flesh has grown, you see, and he can't move the hand anymore. What has he achieved? You see, but unfortunately, in every religion there is that misunderstanding of mortification, mortification of the flesh. Though, for instance, in the Gita or Buddha, you find condemnation to these practices, and still people go on trying to practice. I'll tell you one incident. At Belur Math, in our monastery, there came a so-called holy man, and he built a brick wall circle where he couldn't lie down, it was so narrow, so that he had to stand all the time, practicing austerity. And then somebody asked Maharaj Swami Brahmananda, do they achieve anything? Then he replied, I don't know. But you know why that man is doing that austerity? He thinks by practicing such austerity, in his next life he would be born a very rich man. Or he has some such desire, worldly desire. Then my master explained to us what austerity really means. It is the control of passions and devotion directing our minds to God. That is the meaning of true austerity. Now, I have no other question here. Please ask.
The oral questions from the audience are being revoiced due to their being off mic during the original recording. Swami, can you tell us something about Shankara's life?
Shankara's life is very interesting, but you know, legends are there. How far historical is very difficult to No. But, you know, whatever I know, this very little that I know of his life, which I consider as true, and the rest are legendary. But there is this idea in Shankara's life. I have written that short life in the beginning of the book here, you know. And when he was a young boy, his father died. And at that time he began to discriminate and realize how everything is so evanescent. And this is what he wrote. Who is thy wife? Who is thy son? The ways of this world are strange indeed. Whose art thou? Whence art thou come? Vast is thy ignorance, my beloved. Therefore, ponder these things and worship the Lord. Behold the folly of man, in childhood busy with his toys, in youth bewitched by love, in age bowed down with cares, and always unmindful of the Lord. The hours fly, the seasons roll, life ebbs, but the breeze of hope blows continually in his heart. And thus he goes on, when he was a little child, 6 or 7 years old. And then he renounced the world when he was about 8 years old, with the permission of his mother. Of course, there's a legend to that again, which I do not know how far it is true. The legend is this, that he went to bathe. First his mother would not give any permission. So he went to bathe in the river, and a crocodile got hold of him. And so his mother comes running to save the boy, and the boy says, "Mother, nothing can save me unless you give me permission to renounce the world." And so what could the poor mother do? Said, "Yes, I give you the permission." And then the crocodile left him. You see, this is a legend. And then he went first to, this is also, I do not know how far it is true. He went first to the great well-known saint and philosopher, Gaudapada. You will find, I have written some philosophy of Gaudapada in the book Spiritual Heritage. He was the first philosopher of Vedanta. But Gaudapada said, "No, I am too old now, I am not taking any disciple. You go to my disciple known as Govindapada." So he went to this guru and he heard that Mahavakya, you know, that thou art. And as soon as he heard that, he got that experience. So this story tells us. And then there's a legend here, which of course I cannot accept. It is like this. His guru Govindapada was meditating when the flood came, meditating by the beach, you know. And the flood came, the ocean. And he was about to be drowned, because he was unconscious, you know, in his meditation, completely absorbed. And so Shankara, you know, he had the ocean in his pot, bound. And then, of course, Govindapada woke up and said, "Now leave the ocean alone, you know." So there's that legend. And then when he was 16, he wrote all the commentaries of the Gita, the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras. These are the famous commentaries of Shankara. And then he wrote volumes and volumes of books, prayers and chants. And this, you know, this is one of the major works, Vivekachuramani. And then he preached all over India. You see, at that time, Buddhism in its degraded form invaded India. And he really cleared up the whole situation. And then there was not one Buddhist anymore at that time, you know. They were all converted back to Vedanta. And of course there is another legend which is very interesting, perhaps. He thought that he had to convert one great scholar. He didn't believe in renunciation. He didn't believe in sannyas. And he didn't believe in this Vedantic ideal of attaining oneness with Brahman. He believed only in action, work. And he realized that he had such an influence amongst the scholars, also amongst the lay people of India, that if he is not converted, then his whole life would not be a success. So somehow he approached this man, and at that time he was engaged in certain ceremonial worship. And as he saw this young monk, he got mad. And so the conversation goes this way. Where from does this shaven head appear? Well, you have eyes to see, it appears from here. Ah. You see, he was talking mad, being mad at him, and Shankara was replying in a very humorous way. And then there was another scholar there, and he said, now look here. This young monk is somebody. You better pay heed to him. So his name was Mannan Misra, this scholar. So he asked him, what is it you want? I want to debate with you. You are upholding this work, action. And I am in favor of knowledge. Without knowledge, there is no liberation. So I want to debate and discuss with you. And this condition, that if you can defeat me, I will become a householder, that is, get married and live like you. And if you are defeated, you have to become a monk. You have to renounce. Then this scholar said, that's very good. So he was very happy that he could get this young man to get married, you know. He was very happy about it. Then he says, but who should be the umpire? Then Shankara says, your wife, she's a great learned scholar. Let her be the umpire. And so she became the umpire. Now again the legend is, but this is historical, but the legend, you know, some things got in. The legend says that, it may be true, I don't know. The wife said, now, he is my husband and he is a monk. Husband is God, a monk is God. And I have to be very impartial. So he put a garland on her husband and put a garland on Shankara. And he said, whoever is defeated, his garland will get dried up first. Now, of course, they debated, and Mannan Misra realized that he is being defeated. You know, he was a very sincere man. So he says, and the garland also dried up. So he says, I admit defeat. Now I want to follow your path. Then this wife, who was the umpire, he said, oh, no, no, no. You are not defeated yet completely. I am your half. He has to defeat me. And so she says, now enter into an argument with me. Of course, Shankara had to agree. And then she asked him, she gave him this question. Now look here, I know you are a man of God. I know that nobody can defeat you in scriptures or philosophy or religion. So I am not going to enter into discussion on those subjects. I want to enter into this, to enter on this one subject, sex. And this poor young man, he couldn't say that I would not enter into such discussion, because then his whole thing is foiled. Because this wife pointed out that this also is something that one has to have knowledge. So he says, all right, I will enter into that discussion. Give me 1 month's time. So what he did was, he was a monk. How could he get any knowledge or experience of sex? So he told his disciples, look, I'm going to be absorbed and leave my body here, and you take care of my body. And then he realized through his yoga power that there was a king who was dying or about to die. And so he went to that body, and when this soul left the body, he entered into that body. And so in the king's body, you know, not in his own body, he entered into the king's body. And he had two wives. And so he experienced. And these two wives realized that he was just like a little boy learning, you know. And then they realized in the kingdom that some holy man has entered into this body. And so they would not allow any monk to come to the kingdom. And you see, this Shankara even became forgetful. You see, he was getting caught. And then his disciples realized what was happening. So they did not dress themselves, did not go in their real monk dress, monastic dress. They became, oh, I forget what word. Music. Minstrel. They dressed like minstrels and entered the kingdom and began to chant the compositions of Shankara himself, you know. Who is thy wife? Who is thy husband? You see, and you are Brahman, Shivoham, Shivoham, you know, that famous chant. And then Shankara realized in this body, ah. So he came out of the body fell dead, and he entered into his own body. And then he comes to this wife, and of course this wife, she was a great yogi herself. As soon as Shankara entered into her presence, she says, don't have to argue, I admit defeat. And so Manan Mishra became one of the foremost disciples of Shankara. And he wrote the commentary of Shankara's commentary. And he designated that commentary of his in the name of his wife. and which is of course read by every student of Vedanta. I mean in Sanskrit. You also study, but you see what I can explain. Om Hari Om Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahanau Bhunaktu Sahavirjam Karavavahai Tejasvinavati Tamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om, may Brahman protect us, may guide us, may He give us strength and right understanding. May we have love for all. May our study bring light unto us. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Peace, peace.